Today is April 25th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Mario Ritter in Washington. Coming up, North Korean leader Kim Jong-un meets with Russian President Vladimir Putin in an effort to get a break on sanctions.
Putin says the North is ready to make the move, but needs serious security guarantees to do so.
And we talk with VOA's Catherine Gibson about the political struggle between President Donald Trump and Congress over documents and testimony, and violence is hurting the effort to end a deadly disease and through vaccinations in Pakistan. It's all on today's International Edition. President Donald Trump is fighting with Congress over the release of information. Powerful congressional committee chairpersons are seeking information about the president and his administration. The House Judiciary Committee wants secret details about the recently completed Mueller report on Russian interference in the 2016 election. Others want testimony from former or current administration officials. Another committee is seeking Trump's tax returns. The president has accused opposition Democratic Party lawmakers of using their investigative powers as a political strategy for next year's presidential election. Democratic Oversight Committee Chairman Elijah Cummings, however, has said the president appears to believe that the Constitution does not apply to his White House. While Congress is issuing orders for the information they are seeking, the House also is considering impeaching Trump. Some House members say there is enough evidence of what the Constitution calls high crimes and misdemeanors to bring about the process. To help us understand this political struggle, we have with us Catherine Gibson, VOA's congressional correspondent. Catherine, thank you for being with us.
You're so very welcome.
Catherine, committee chairs are seeking the unredacted Mueller report, the testimony of Trump's former White House counsel and others. What does Congress want out of this process?
Well, what the House Democratic majority would say that they want is to finally, after 2 years of an unregulated Congress, is to provide oversight of the Trump administration. They feel that it's Congress's duty under the U.S. constitutional system to provide a check and balance on the president. So this is part of a bigger picture of oversight that they want to enact now that they do hold that majority in the U.S. House of Representatives.
Now, the president is fighting the release of his tax returns going back 6 years. Does Congress have the power to ask anyone to release this information? Can the president ignore the demand? And what will Congress do if they get the tax returns?
Well, we're certainly finding out what does happen when the president ignores those demands. He's saying that he won't provide them, and that's putting the House Judiciary Committee in a unique position. They're having to decide, well, if the administration is ignoring a subpoena, then could we possibly jail administration members? Now, that would be unprecedented, and what will more likely happen is that they would seek a way to fine the members of the administration if they don't provide that information. Trump is fighting about providing his tax returns. What they're really arguing, the House Democratic majority is that they have oversight capability over the Internal Revenue Service. They're saying that they could provide oversight over anyone's tax returns, not just the president. So they're taking a little bit of a different approach than some of the other subpoenas that they're putting out against the administration to provide this information.
And for those who are not closely following the details of the political struggle, what is at stake when Democrats say there is enough evidence to go forward with impeachment, the beginning of the legislative process to remove a sitting president?
Well, right. So this is certainly a topic of much discussion and debate, even within the House Democratic majority up on Capitol Hill. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi has said at some points before the Mueller report was released that impeaching President Trump was, quote, just not worth it. She's looking ahead to the 2020 U.S. presidential election. She's thinking that Democrats are best positioned if they go after other kitchen table issues like the economy, student debt, housing costs, instead of making this a partisan political battle against President Trump. Now, some members of her caucus disagree with that. They think that President Trump should be impeached immediately, that he has committed those, quote, high crimes and misdemeanors that make a president worthy of impeachment. I think you'll see some very interesting discussions in the coming weeks as members of Congress return from their two-week break. They're back on Capitol Hill for the first time since the Mueller report was released. They'll be holding intense discussions about how to proceed in the coming weeks and months.
Catherine Gibson, VOA correspondent for Congress, thanks for being with us.
You're so welcome.
Former U.S. Vice President Joe Biden has announced that he will seek the 2020 Democratic Party presidential nomination. The 76-year-old longtime senator from Delaware and vice president under President Barack Obama is a well-known name in the party. Biden has extensive experience in international affairs, justice issues, and domestic issues as a senator. But there are questions about his ability to raise enough money to compete with competitors in his party. Biden's main rival appears to be Senator Bernie Sanders of Vermont. AP's Sagar Magani has more on Biden's viability as a presidential candidate in an already crowded field of Democratic challengers to President Trump.
In a video announcement, Biden says America could not afford 8 years of Donald Trump in the White House.
He will forever and fundamentally alter the character of this nation.
Biden says he could not stand by and watch that, so he's launched his third White House bid, becoming at least the 20th Democrat seeking a shot at knocking out the president.
He starts in it with a healthy lead over his other competitors.
St. Anselm College analyst Chris Galdieri also pointing out Biden's age. He's 76 and would be the oldest person ever elected president. There are also questions about his appeal in a party steadily moving to the left. Sagar Magani, Washington.
Among the top stories in the world, tens of thousands of people in Sudan's capital today took part in what organizers called a million-strong march in support of civilian rule. Afghans in Kabul are preparing for a meeting involving tribal elders and local leaders in an effort for peace. And the United Nations says it is evacuating more than 300 refugees threatened by fighting near Libya's capital, Tripoli. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on voanews.com and VOA's mobile app. This is International Edition. North Korean leader Kim Jong-un and Russian President Vladimir Putin have promised to improve ties at a meeting in the city of Vladivostok in far eastern Russia. However, the first meeting between the young North Korean leader and the Russian president did not move forward nuclear talks with the United States. Kim went to Russia hoping for help against economic sanctions that have hurt his country's economy. After the meeting, Putin said he is open to development projects, such as a fuel pipeline or railway projects through North Korea. But he did not appear to offer sanctions relief to Kim. Putin also raised the possibility of a return to six-party talks on North Korea's nuclear weapons program. Those talks involve North Korea and South Korea, China, Japan, Russia, and the U.S., but they broke down more than 10 years ago. The U.S. has remained firm in its demands that North Korea move its nuclear weapons program towards an end before international sanctions are eased. A second leaders' meeting in Hanoi, Vietnam, failed to produce any agreement toward that goal. AP correspondent Charles de Ledesma reports that Putin is offering to talk to President Trump about North Korea's stance.
Putin says the North is ready to make the move, but but needs serious security guarantees to do so. Russia's president says he is ready to share details from the summit with President Donald Trump, as there are no secrets, adding that Kim himself has encouraged him to explain the nuances of Pyongyang's stance if he talks to Trump about the talks. Putin notes that Russia and the US both want North Korea to abandon nuclear weapons, but suggests guarantees should likely be underwritten by multiple countries. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
The United States announced earlier this week that it is ending exemptions given to five countries that continue to buy Iranian oil. The U.S. says those countries must stop oil purchases by May 1st or face sanctions. China, the top buyer of Iranian oil, and Iran's neighbor Turkey are firmly opposed to the move and are testing the Trump administration's approach of using sanctions as a foreign policy tool. White House correspondent Patsy Widakuswara has this story.
A strike at Tehran's lifeline as the United States moves to end Iran's oil export. Earlier this week, the Trump administration announced it will stop giving waivers to China, India, Japan, South Korea, and Turkey, countries that continue to buy Iranian oil after Washington pulled out of the 2015 nuclear deal with Tehran last May and reinstated sanctions. If they do not comply, they too may face U.S. sanctions. Mike Pompeo is the U.S. Secretary of State.
Any nation or entity interacting with Iran should do its diligence and err on the side of caution. The risks are simply not going to be worth the benefits.
In dealing with adversaries, the Trump administration often turns to unilateral sanctions rather than build coalitions to pressure a target country to change its behavior, say some analysts. Bill Reinsch is an analyst at the Center of Strategic and International Studies.
It will not make things better. It will make them worse. It will alienate the five countries that are involved.
China buys about half of Iran's oil and resolutely opposes the move. Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesman Geng Shuang.
The cooperation between China and Iran is open, transparent, reasonable, and legitimate, which thus deserves respect.
Iran's neighbor Turkey also denounced the move. Turkish Foreign Minister Mevlut Cavusoglu.
Politically, it is not right. Ethically, it is not right. In terms of commerce, it is definitely not right.
India, the second largest buyer, has signaled it will comply. But in the past, they have bypassed sanctions using a payment system based on the rupee instead of U.S. dollars. Countries which are not complying can choose to negotiate, retaliate, or since transactions are made by private companies, they could also cheat. Bill Reinsch of CSIS.
It will be hard for the U.S. administration to take action against private tankers that are owned by private companies that are foreign flagged. It'll cause diplomatic issues if they attempt to do that.
On Tuesday, oil prices hit a six-month high following signals from Gulf OPEC members that they will raise output to offset oil shortfalls only if there is enough demand. Bob Yauger is the director of futures of Mitsuho Americas.
The Saudis have not come out and really put out a strong message that they would help replace any barrels that are lost in the process of ending the Iranian waiver program.
Iran has threatened to retaliate by blocking the Strait of Hormuz. The United States has said it would stop any Iranian attempt to block the waterway, which carries a fifth of the world's oil trade. Patsy Widakuswara, VOA News at the White House.
You're listening to VOA's International Edition.
VOA's Learning English is available online at learningenglish.voanews.com. Check out our programs such as Let's Learn English, English in a Minute, Everyday Grammar, and many more. VOA's Learning English, your reliable source for learning English.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, and on my program Jazz America, I carry on the tradition begun decades ago by the great Willis Conover by exploring the wonders of a century of jazz history. I'll cover it all from Dixieland to swing to bebop to modal, free jazz, fusion, world jazz, contemporary, and beyond. Plus, you'll hear the words of the artists themselves as they tell their incredible stories. Join me for Jazz America, Saturdays and Sundays at 13 hours Universal Time, online at voanews.com and the Voice of America.
Security agencies from around the world are in Sri Lanka to help investigate Sunday's deadly series of bombings aimed at Christians and foreigners. The Islamic State militants have claimed to have worked with the attackers, who Sri Lankan officials say were members of a domestic Islamic extremist group. The suicide bombing attacks killed more than 350 people and wounded about 500. Michael Kugelman is Deputy Director of the Asia Program and Senior Associate for South Asia at the Wilson Center. He tells my colleague Ira Melman he is certain that IS, also known as ISIS, was involved.
You know, the group that was identified as the perpetrator is a very small Islamist radical group that has been around for a few years, is extremist in its ideology and in its thinking, but is very small and really has not done much other than, as I understand it, deface, spray paint a few Buddhist statues a few years ago after there had been some Buddhist mobs had attacked Muslims in Sri Lanka. So this is a group, it goes by the acronym NTJ. It does not have any type of capacity to stage an attack like what we saw. I mean, if what had happened on Sunday had simply been, you know, a guy throwing a grenade at a single church, then sure. I mean, you could argue that that would not need any type of support from the outside. But, you know, we're talking about, you know, several attacks staged in a coordinated fashion. There's no way that the small group could have done it. And the only outside group that would have the capacity and the desire, I would argue, at this point in time to help would be ISIS. It staged attacks very much like the one that we saw. It's gone after religious minorities. The attack really had all the hallmarks of ISIS. So I think that it definitely was involved.
How much has ISIS gone into South Asian countries?
Yeah, well, I mean, ISIS does have a footprint in South Asia. And I should say ISIS has a South Asia affiliate. It's called ISIS Khorasan, ISIS-K. It was formally established back in 2014. It's largely based in Afghanistan, particularly in eastern Afghanistan, and it has carried out attacks in Afghanistan in previous years. It also has a smaller presence in Pakistan. Very interestingly enough, it also has a footprint in Bangladesh. And in fact, you may remember a few years ago, there was this horrific attack on a bakery in Dhaka, Bangladesh, that was popular place for foreigners to go to. It killed several dozen people, including foreigners. That attack was carried out by a local Islamist group in Bangladesh with cooperation from ISIS. So the model there was very similar to what seems to be emerging to be the case in Sri Lanka, where you have a local radical group essentially contracting with ISIS. ISIS essentially provides the probably a lot of money and organizational support and other things. So to answer your question, we had this attack in Sri Lanka, which is clearly the first attack that ISIS has ever been involved with in Sri Lanka. But they do have a presence, a longstanding presence in the broader region. And you talk about India, certainly ISIS has a modest but nonetheless a real presence in India. There have been a number of ISIS members or sympathizers arrested there in recent years. This ISIS is there in South Asia, and not just in South Asia. It's been involved in attacks in the Philippines and Indonesia as well.
So they have not been defeated, is that correct?
No, not at all. Certainly on a tactical level, it has been defeated in Syria and Iraq, where it's lost all the territory that it had controlled. But, you know, the group continues to exist. It still has a lot of resources, a lot of capacity, a lot of money, and it has the ability to carry out catastrophic attacks. And I think that will be the big thing to worry about, particularly with all of these fighters, these foreign fighters that had gone to Syria and Iraq to be a part of the caliphate, so to speak. Now that that caliphate is destroyed, you know, those foreign fighters that hadn't been killed, you know, a lot of them have gone back to their home countries, including Sri Lanka. They've gone back to Europe. So I think one thing we really have to worry about looking forward is ISIS essentially looking to these returned fighters, trying to essentially take advantage of freedoms and access and open access in these Western democracies and staging attacks.
That was Michael Kugelman, an expert on South Asia at the Wilson Center here in Washington. He spoke with VOA's Ira Melman. Tropical cyclone Kenneth will hit northern Mozambique and southern Tanzania in the coming hours, with wind gusts topping 250 kilometers an hour. The storm left large parts of the Comoros without power after passing over the island nation last night. Reuters news agency says the storm caused at least 3 deaths in the Comoros. VOA's Swahili service has received photos from the Comoros citizens showing extensive damage to homes and roads. The governments of Mozambique and Tanzania are urging people to evacuate from coastal communities because of an expected storm surge of up to 5 meters. They also are pushing for people to leave low-lying areas near rivers where floods are possible. Mozambique, Zimbabwe, and Malawi are still recovering from Cyclone Idai, which hit 6 weeks ago. More than 800 people died after the storm hit the region, and hundreds of thousands lost their homes, crops, livestock, or businesses. International aid agencies are rushing supplies and personnel to the storm zone. In Pakistan, police say unidentified gunmen have shot dead a female polio vaccine worker and wounded another. It is the third attack against health workers during a national immunization campaign. Today's shooting took place in southeastern Baluchistan province, where police said attackers on a motorbike opened fire on the polio team. They described the condition of the surviving female health worker as critical. An official with the polio emergency center in Quetta confirmed that officials have temporarily suspended the vaccination campaign in the area. The other attacks took place in a northwestern province near the border with Afghanistan. In related developments, officials arrested 10 men in the provincial capital of Peshawar for spreading rumors about the vaccination campaign. The men used fake social ID videos to suggest the vaccines made children ill. Pakistan is one of 3 countries in the world where the wild polio virus is still endemic. The other two are Afghanistan and Nigeria, although Nigeria has not reported any new cases for 2 straight years. You have been listening to International Edition. You can find us at voanews.com. Thanks for joining us, and thanks to our director, Patrice Martin. I'm Mario Ritter in Washington. Be sure to enjoy your day.
In a minute.
Take a listen to this. That, according to NASA, is the sound of a Mars quake. Members of the space agency's InSight team report that the Mars lander measured and, for the first time, captured the audio signal of faint seismic activity that they say appears to be coming from the inside of the red planet. NASA says their scientists are still checking data to determine the exact cause of the signal. The sounds and measurements of the Mars quake were captured on April 6, 2019, its 128th Martian day or sol, by InSight Seismic Experiment for Interior Structure Instrument. The InSight lander was launched in May 2018, and its seismometer was placed on the surface of the red planet in December 2018. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, and on my program, Jazz America, I carry on the tradition begun decades ago by the great Willis Conover by exploring the wonders of a century of jazz history. I'll cover it all from Dixieland to swing to bebop to modal, free jazz, fusion, world jazz, contemporary, and beyond. Plus, you'll hear the words of the artists themselves as they tell their incredible stories. Join me for Jazz America, Saturdays and Sundays at 13 hours Universal Time, online at voanews.com and the Voice.